supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, and most of you, my age or younger, know exactly what that was. That was Billy Joel, You Didn't Start the Fire, and most of you had all sorts of thoughts, maybe emotions, while you were listening to the song. Most of you were hearing the words, perhaps. So what happens to us when we hear music? What goes on in our brains? Why do some of us think about events and other of us complete the songs, and some play entire symphonies or concertos inside our own heads? Research shows that music has a tremendous impact on the brain and can actually heal it when it's injured. It can bring us joy in terms of sadness. It can create sadness and reinforce it. So how does it actually affect the brain, and how does it transform our lives, and vice versa? We're joined by author and researcher, well-known neurologist Oliver Sacks. His latest book is Musicophilia, and we're also joined by Daniel Levitin. He's the author of The World in Six Songs. He's a cognitive psychologist and a music producer, or ex-music producer. He's also on the phone at McGill University in Montreal. Oliver, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you.
And Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Oliver, I want to play a piece of music that might sound familiar to you, and then I want to get your reaction to it. Let's listen. So, Oliver Sacks, tell us your reaction to Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto.
Okay, well, that takes me back many years to 1974, when I had a nasty accident on a mountain and disabled a leg and had to have surgery and was in hospital and had difficulty, and I'd really sort of forgotten how to use the leg or how to walk. The thing had been in a cast, and I'd been in bed for 3 weeks. And when I was stood up, I started to walk rather clumsily. One foot got in front of the other one. I couldn't decide how large a step should be. And then suddenly, the Mendelssohn, of which I'd had a tape on a cassette player in my room, and I'd been playing it, in fact, constantly. It was the only music I had with me in those 3 weeks in my hospital room, and it suddenly started very vividly in my mind as an image, very almost a hallucination, and I found myself walking to the music. The rhythm and the feeling and the tempo of the music somehow seemed to teach me how to walk.
Oliver, you used the word image.
Yes.
You had an image? What was that like?
Well, the music played in my mind, and you know, it was in my imagination, so in my memory.
So, what happened in your brain that the music enabled your leg to move properly?
Well, I can only sort of hazard a thought, which is that human beings spontaneously move, they keep time, they dance to the beat of music. And I think it was above all, the rhythm and the beat of the Mendelssohn, which somehow activated me. There are connections which seem to be unique in human beings between the auditory parts of the brain and the motor parts of the brain. And from the age of two or so, children, human beings keep time to music. And I suspect that this was going on and that it might have some similarity to what I'd seen in some of my own patients.
Well, I also wonder the other side, what we're learning about the brain now, is it distracted your brain also. Not distracted per se, but we know that when we concentrate too hard on something, it's more difficult to access.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point. And when say, people with Parkinson's disease are stuck, they may be looking at their feet, and you want to say, look over there, just and give them a goal and then you can unstick them. And I think distraction might have been part of it.
Yeah, it's almost exactly how meditation is so effective, that, you know, when you feel anxiety, you take a step back and look at the whole being, look at the experience of the moment. Don't focus on fixing the anxiety.
Yeah, and I had to get the feeling, sort of the intentionality of walking and the idea of going somewhere and not sort of gazing at my feet.
Hmm. Daniel, when you were young, you fell in love with this song. Let's listen. We have... Now, we know right off the bat that was not Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto.
No.
Yeah, I'm good like that.
I grew up in California, just over the hills from Berkeley, and Creedence Clearwater Revival was kind of a hometown band for us. They had played around as the Gollywogs for many years before they changed their name.
Well, in 1969, you know, there's a part of all of our hearts and souls that were living in California.
I think so.
Especially
Northern. I know Oliver was there in spirit also.
yeah, I was there in the early 60s.
You called musical hallucinations, Daniel.
Yes, well, I think that Dr. Sachs and I share these with many musicians and musically inclined people, especially as you're just falling asleep or just waking. There's a technical term for these. They're either hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations, where you're sort of in that netherworld between sleep and wakefulness, and you're not really sure where you are or what's going on, and one's head fills with these sometimes very vivid and elaborate sounds. They could be music that you've heard before or music you've never heard before, and I've had those all my life, and I find them very beautiful and comforting.
Not irritating.
No, not at all. It's not the same as having a song stuck in your head throughout the day while you're trying to do something else. You're lying in bed, and you're really not trying to do anything else.
Did Creedence Clearwater Revival contribute to your decision to become a music producer?
Well, they did, because they, along with many other artists, and I would include in there Beethoven and Mendelssohn and Miles Davis, they just made it all seem so easy. And of course it's not, but that's one of the great things that experts can do now, isn't it? Just as I wanted to become a writer from having read Dr. Sachs's books and thinking, boy, he makes it look so easy to write, and it turns out it's not.
Oh, really? I'm sure Oliver would agree with you that it's not easy.
No, it's not easy, and you do a beautiful job yourself, Daniel.
Well, thank you, but I think that the thing that I take from great musicians and great writers is that they're somehow able to make it seem as though it's effortless, and I think as listeners and viewers of art, we respond to that.
Sure. Let me reintroduce you, and I want to give out the phone number. Obviously, we're talking about music and its impact on our brains, our lives, and vice versa. You just heard the voice of Daniel Levitin. He's the author of The World in Six Songs. He's a cognitive psychologist, and he joins us by phone from McGill in Montreal. Oliver Sacks, as many of you know, is a neurologist, author, researcher. His book is Musicophilia. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Please give us a call. That's 888-477-9499. Oliver, I want to talk about these musical hallucinations. In your book, you mentioned a patient who had them. She was deaf, but because her condition deteriorated, she was placed on steroids. Tell us about her and what happened after she was placed on steroids.
She didn't notice any effect for about a week, and then 8 or 9 days afterwards, she was woken at night by a tremendous noise outside the window. She heard shouting, she heard bells, she heard sirens. She thought a fire engine had stopped. And she rushed to the window, and there was nothing there. And she was very startled, and startled as too. She was in a state of consternation. She realized this must be a hallucination, and it was an extremely loud one. Then, rather suddenly, the clamor was replaced by music. And this was the start of her musical hallucinations, which originally took the form of either hymns or popular songs dating back to her childhood or her early days.
So why do you call them hallucinations rather than memories?
Because they seem to have an external cause and an external source. Whenever people have something like this, whether it's a visual hallucination or a musical or whatever, with a musical hallucination, you'll see if the radio's on, is the television on, is there a band outside, has someone put on a cassette. And only when you can't find an external source, then you have to acknowledge that a part of your brain is behaving very strangely. And this can be very frightening. People say, you know, hearing things, am I going mad? Am I losing my brain? And one never has this sort of confusion with one's own imagery. You know it's yours. It's your imagination.
So what happened with this woman when she was put on steroids?
I doubt if steroids alone would have caused something like this. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are on steroids, but this sort of hallucination is commoner in people with, or fairly common with people with very impaired hearing. And there's sometimes a critical stage when there's a little further loss of hearing, and then the hallucinations start. And one has to suspect here that when the auditory parts of the brain, if you want, the musical parts of the brain, aren't getting their usual sort of input, aren't hearing things, then they will start to sort of reach down into memory and generate music by themselves. There seems to be a very similar thing with vision. When people's vision becomes very bad, they're liable to have visual hallucinations.
And you talked about people who were visually impaired. I'm going to follow up on that with both of you. More likely to have something called perfect pitch.
Perfect pitch or absolute pitch. In England, the terms are synonymous. I'm not quite sure if they're synonymous here, but that's pretty rare in an adult population. But it seems to be very much commoner in those who are born blind. And one series in England suggests that half the people who are congenitally blind have and retain absolute pitch. But I know Daniel has been doing research on this, and he can probably put things more in focus.
What makes that unusual, Daniel?
Well, perfect pitch or absolute pitch, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with the term, it's the ability that many well, some musicians have, I shouldn't say many, some, to when they hear a tone, it could be from a musical instrument or even a car horn or a tinkling glass, they can tell you what note it would be on the piano, for example. They can say, oh, well, that car horn is in E-flat, or did you hear that dog bark? It was a C-sharp. Most of us can't do that. What most musicians can do is they can tell you what a minor third is when they hear one. They can name the intervals. Or if you play them a tone and then give them a reference, they can sort of calculate their way from the reference to name the tone. And it seems necessary to acquire it as a child. There are no reported cases of an adult requiring absolute pitch. And it requires a kind of systematic exposure to the tones and their labels. Nobody's born knowing a label like C-sharp. You don't pop out of the womb with that vocabulary. But during a critical period of childhood, one needs to make a link between these terms that musicians use for the names of the notes and the sound. And nobody seems to understand why it is that the congenitally blind have a higher incidence of it, although it's plausible that they would attend more acutely to sound because they're missing one of their senses. That doesn't necessarily entail that they would develop super absolute pitch as opposed to super relative pitch.
I should say you mentioned children and coming out of the womb. After our break, we're going to take a break in a few minutes, but after that we're going to talk with Concetta Tomeno, and she has a great deal of knowledge about developmental issues in the brains with children. She is a contributor to the Mozart Effect, so we're going to flesh that out a little more. Let's get a phone call, and we've got our phone lines are lit up, and everybody wants to make a contribution. Let's start with Luke. Luke, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing, Dr. Sachs, Dr. Gottlieb?
Hi.
Wanted to thank you for writing the book, Dr. Sachs. I'm halfway through it right now, and my question is, I'm a musician. I've been a musician for about 15 years, and I play the drums, so I wanted to see if there was maybe a specific link between playing the drums and the effects that it has on your brain and the way that you process music.
Well, when you get on to the second half of the book, you will in fact find a chapter which is more or less devoted to drumming, in particular to its to the effects of a drum circle on people with Tourette syndrome. And these people who have sudden tics and sort of blurt out words or noises in an unsynchronized, uncoordinated way. And I describe how I'd seen a group of 20-odd people with Tourette's beautifully brought together in a drum circle and sort of internally synchronized and synchronized with each other. I also speak about drum circles. Mickey Hart has been very, very important here in sort of evangelizing these for people with Alzheimer's disease and other problems. I'd referred earlier to rhythm and beat, and drumming is very important, and sort of primal.
Dr. Sachs made an interesting point at the top of the hour, which is that humans are the only species that can synchronize, and this is really true. Chimpanzees will bang on sticks, but two chimpanzees can't synchronize their banging. It's only humans that can do it, and infants can do it automatically. We think it has to do with mirror neurons, which are able to take input from one sensory channel, from the ear, and turn that into what we call a motor action plan. You hear through the ear, and then you make, with your voice or your hands or your body, something that's synchronous with what you heard. And the very fact that infants can do this before they even know how to think about their movements illustrates that it's an automatic process with a very ancient evolutionary origin.
What about birds?
Birds can imitate also. They have structures including, they have the genetic basis for this in the FOXP2 gene, which is associated with language. They can imitate sound, but they can't synchronize.
Well, you know, there's curiously, I've just been reading a paper by a colleague of ours, Dr. Patel in California.
Yes.
And he has done some rather careful testing on one of these self-sequestered cockatoos, and YouTube pictures have been going around of these cockatoos apparently dancing, and he in fact confirms that they can modify the speed of their dancing to synchronize with some inputs. And so maybe we are the only mammal who does this, but it may be that birds, some birds, at least songbirds, do it as well.
Interesting. Well, Luke, thanks so much for your call. Thanks for the the discussion that it triggered. We are running late for our break, and we have to take it. I just want to play one more piece of music, and this is for you, Daniel, because, you know, when we last left our little biography of Daniel Levitin, you were a music producer, in part impelled by Creedence Clearwater Revival. You are now a cognitive psychologist, and I want to play a piece of music that contributed to the transition, and I want to play it mostly because I love this musician.
Ladies and gents, turn up the sound system to the sound of Carlos Santana in the GMB. Ghetto Blues from the refugee camp.
Oh, Maria, Maria, she remind me of a West Side Story, growing up in Spanish Harlem.
Well, Daniel, that might not have been the best choice of Carlos Santana, but it's one of my favorites, so
yep.
So I got to pick it. So what happened to you when you heard Carlos Santana?
I had this extraordinary experience of being able to work in recording studios for many years with many fine artists, and there was a pivotal moment in my recording career where I was sitting in the studio recording Carlos playing a guitar solo. It was just the two of us. And some tape machines. And as he played, I started to get goosebumps, which wasn't unusual, of course, in that situation. But what was unusual was that on that particular day, I started to wonder where they came from. What was going on in the mind of this great musician that allowed him to communicate in such a way that I was getting goosebumps? You know, my skin was crawling. The hair on the nape of my neck was standing up. And I was curious about it, that by him banging on some pieces of metal strung across a piece of wood, he could cause this intense physical and emotional reaction in me, and I began reading as much as I could about the brain, and eventually, as you mentioned earlier, I went back to school and took a degree in cognitive neuroscience.
Well, you know, thank you, Carlos Santana, for yet another thing.
Another surprising thing.
we've got to take our break. We'll come back with more callers, and we will be speaking with Conchetta Tomeno. She's director of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function for Music Therapy at Beth Abraham Family for Health Studies. I'm also joined here on the telephone by Oliver Sacks, neurologist, author, researcher's latest book is Musicophilia. Daniel Levitin is author of The World in Six Songs. He's a cognitive psychologist, professor of psychology and music at McGill University in Montreal. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Winter Tour Museum and Country Estate presents the 45th Annual Delaware Antique Show, November 7th through 9th at the Chase Center on the riverfront in Wilmington, Delaware, featuring 62 dealers specializing in American antiques and decorative arts, including furniture, paintings, rugs, ceramics, jewelry, and more. Preview party tickets, show tickets, and details at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Winter Tour supports WHYY.
This is Christine Dempsey, WHYY's Chief Content Officer. Thank you for making our fall membership campaign a success. In turbulent times, being connected to 91FM means you'll hear the full story, gain new perspective, and learn the complexity of the issues. As you navigate this election season, we'll continue to deliver this level of news service that's made possible in large part by member support. To learn more about the WHYY membership experience, visit whyy.org. Thanks.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, the crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time.
Now, you might wonder why I chose to play Elvis and Hound Dog. I chose to play Elvis and Hound Dog because we're doing a show on music, and of course you just have to play Elvis and Hound Dog on a show on music. So we're going to talk about what music does to our brains with Oliver Sacks, neurologist, author, researcher, who's written Musicophilia, among many other books. Daniel Levitin, he's the author of The World in Six Songs, and by the way, we're going to find out about those songs. He's also a cognitive psychologist, professor of psychology and music at McGill University, and I'm also joined by Concetta Tomeno. She's a director of the Music Institute for Music and Neurologic Function, and she's also vice president for music therapy at Beth Abraham Family Health Services. Concetta, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
I want to bring up a question with, I guess, all of you. I'll turn to you first, Oliver, since you're a neurologist. You know the old TV commercials, this is your brain on drugs, and we know that the brain looks supposedly like a fried egg when it's on drugs, but I want to know what the brain on music looks like and how it differs from a brain who is in deep prayer or meditation, or a brain who is watching the Phillies clinch the World Series, which is about to happen.
Well, of course, This Is Your Brain on Music is the title of Daniel's first book, and a beautiful book. But now, using functional brain imaging, it's possible to see different parts of the brain activated when people listen to music, or when they imagine music, or when they hallucinate music, or when they compose music. You find that there's really no... there's a very widespread activation. There's no one musical center in the brain. Auditory parts of the brain light up, but visual parts light up, frontal lobes light up, and primitive parts of the brain, motor parts of the brain, and cerebellum, basal ganglia light up.
Well, I want to turn to Daniel then. We heard on this show Mendelssohn, Carlos Santana, and Elvis Presley. Did the same parts of the brain light up for all three of them?
Well, yes and no. Some of the same parts would.
Typical psychologist. Yes and no. Go on.
Some of the same parts would, but music is very subjective. We don't all like the same thing. And so those parts of the brain that communicate pleasure or distaste, excitement or boredom to us, are going to be different across different people. And areas such as the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area, which signal pleasure, it could be hip-hop or heavy metal or classical or Gregorian chants or Chinese opera that does those, depending on what you like. We also know that more rhythmic music activates deeper structures in the brain associated with timing and clocks, internal clocks, structures that Dr. Sacks mentioned, such as the basal ganglia and the cerebellum. An interesting aspect of this is that it's the rhythmic aspects of music that activate these, suggesting, and these are very old phylogenetically, it suggests that rhythm and the perception of it is very old in our species.
Well, it's old in our species, and it's also early, too, because, you know, we talked about how it occurs in infants, that infants are rhythmic, which... Connie, let me turn to you. Is Connie okay?
Yes, Connie's fine.
Thank you. So I made a mistake when I said you contributed to the Mozart effect. I do know you are knowledgeable about it, and it's become pretty controversial.
Sure. You know, my background as a music therapist is really with adults who have lost ability due to neurologic diseases or you know, diseases such as Alzheimer's and dementia. I think I'm mentioned in a book called The Mozart Effect by Don Campbell, and that may be where the confusion came from. But, you know, it's interesting that both Dr. Sachs and Dr. Levitin are talking about the two elements, both rhythm, which is deeply rooted in our brains and well-preserved in people with dementia and neuromuscular problems. You know, we can, as therapists, use rhythm to help facilitate movement for people who can't initiate that by themselves. So, you know, for example, somebody with Parkinson's disease who can't initiate how they walk, or the simplicity of what how they walk, can easily do it when an outside rhythm is played. And people who have dementia, who have disability, and even recognizing familiar faces will increase their attention and responsiveness to music that was familiar and very personally important to them.
Why? What's happening?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe Dr. Sachs and Dr. Levitin can mention that. My assumption by working with people and actually doing clinical research over the years points to the fact that the areas that are stimulated by familiar music are still preserved in people despite cortical damage, and it's because of the stimulation of those areas that are still available to these individuals once they're stimulated can arouse them and increase responsiveness.
I want to come back, if you would, and talk a bit about not necessarily the Mozart effect, but what happens developmentally in infants, even fetuses' brains, how music affects them and doesn't affect them?
I think what the research is showing with child development is that as children are exposed to a variety of music, that the areas of the brain that process rhythmic complexity, harmonic complexity, are also develop along with that. I know in the Mozart effect, one of the things that Francis Rauscher and Gordon Shaw, who were the originators of that research, pointed to that the Mozart that they used, which was the K-448 D major piano sonata, that when that was played for students, that the spatial temporal reasoning was increased. So it was almost like the music was priming areas of attention that would allow for the increase of ability in that particular task.
Well, having learned that, it's being used for ADD and epilepsy, yes?
Yes. There has been some research about using music to decrease epileptic seizures.
How does that work?
I can't say how it works. I just know that people who've done research with it have shown that it decreases the seizures, and probably maybe Dr. Sachs can talk about this. You know, my understanding is that it's stimulating other temporal areas, so maybe can actually turn off the seizure activity in attention to the music itself.
Well,
I can't say.
Oliver, will you address that? Is happening? Because it sounds similar to the people who are, you know, frozen in Parkinsonism, the ones you described in Awakenings.
You mean address the seizure?
Yes.
Curiously, one can, music can have either sort of good or not so good effects with regard to seizures. There are a small number of I worked in an epilepsy clinic for many years, and I saw quite a number of people who had seizures induced by music. Sometimes it was a particular tune, sometimes it was a particular sort of music, sometimes it was particular musical instruments. So music can induce seizures. One speaks of musicogenic epilepsy, but also, you know, since I love contrary examples, for example, in the paperback of my book now, which is a lot fatter than the hardback, I've put in many new contrary histories, including a delightful one of a severely epileptic person who writes that she has never had a seizure while she's playing the piano. She says she has occasionally had a seizure while listening to music, but never while performing music.
It's something that it sounds like it reorganizes the brain. I've got a dear friend of mine who is has a pretty severe stutter or stammer.
Yes.
And he's a professional musician, and he never does that when he is singing. And even when he begins to stutter in the middle of a sentence, he will sing the end of the sentence.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one sees something very, very similar in people with Tourette syndrome. There are a lot of people with severe Tourette's who are performing musicians, and there is not a hint of the Tourette's when they're performing. As you say, the brains are somehow being reconfigured and organized, and there's just a sort of a smooth flow.
Well, Connie, yeah. Let me pose a question to you before we have to say goodbye to you and take our break. We've got a caller on the line who's got a 94-year-old mother-in-law with dementia, and she wants to know how she can use music therapy to help.
Well, usually the best thing, or the first place to try to use music yourself with a relative, is to really find music that would have been personally important to that individual. So if the daughter knows the mother's favorite type of music, we know that when somebody listens to that music, they become relaxed, they become attentive. It can help in transition periods when they are restless. So finding music that's personally important is useful. Using music that's rhythmic to help them move and get their exercise is important as well. And depending on where she's living, she may be able to find a music therapist in that town, and one can look at the American Music Therapy Association to find music therapists in your local area that may be of help.
Hmm. That is helpful. Well, Connie, I want to thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
For joining us. Connie Tomeno is a director of the Music Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. She's also vice president for music therapy, and that's at Beth Abraham Family of Health Services in New York City. We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue to talk with Oliver Sacks, neurologist, author, researcher, who's written Musicophilia, and Daniel Levitin, author of The World in Six Songs, cognitive psychologist and professor of psychology and music at McGill. When we come back, we're going to talk, of course, about the world in those six songs, but we're also going to talk about the heart and soul of music, where we know it's not just located in the brain, it's also located in the heart also. We'll talk about that when we get back. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Orchestra, performing Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, an upbeat celebration of dance rhythms turned into a symphony. The program also includes Schrecker's Prelude to a Drama and Zemlinsky's Scenes from the Dwarf, October 31st through November 1st, under the baton of James Conlon. The Philadelphia Orchestra and James Conlon. Tickets and information available at 215-893-1999 or philorc.org.
Between Morning Edition
and All Things Considered,
we bring you Day to Day.
News, interviews.
If they get to me and they kill me, I can always leave something behind.
And features you won't hear anywhere else.
It's good radio in the middle of the day.
Day to Day from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
It's Friday night. I was in seventh grade. I was dancing with Jenny Gordon, and I was good. And I knew all the words to that song. So That's how I came into music. Elvis I didn't love so much, but right after Elvis was the Duprees. So I want to talk, Daniel, about our relationship with music over time. So I went from, well, my early childhood was, Patti Page, but, I went from the Duprees to the Supremes, and then I went to the Doors. I really thought Light My Fire should have been our national anthem. And now I love Chicago blues, classics, and classical music. So is that about my brain is aging? Is that about my lifestyle? Or is it about memories?
It's about all of these things. It's interesting that you didn't say that you've become a fan of Indian ragas or Chinese opera or pygmy music. Those would be less likely because they're based on different scales. But all the musics that you mentioned, spanning Broadway and Tin Pan Alley, swing, blues, rhythm and blues, rock music, they all use the same chord progressions and the same 12 notes. And what we know now is that during the first 10 years of life or so, our brains are literally wiring themselves up to the rules and the structure of the music and the language that we're raised with. We come to appreciate the structures that govern those forms of communication, and for the most part, tend towards music that falls within those structures.
Well, your answer raised a question in my little mind. Is I wonder if I can download some pygmy music from iTunes.
You can. I think we're living in a golden age for music where there's more music available to the average listener than ever before. Virtually every song ever recorded in the history of the world is available somewhere on the internet for if you can only find it. And we're seeing the consequences of this in modern popular music and even modern classical music, where songwriters and composers are borrowing from traditions that they might only have been able to imagine just a generation ago. I heard the premiere of a wonderful new classical piece by a young composer named Nico Muhly, and the piece is called Wish You Were Here. It was performed by the Kitchener, Ontario Symphony a couple of weeks ago, and it's a gorgeous orchestral piece where he imagines what Balinese gamelan music would sound like to someone who had never heard it, using orchestral instruments to represent it.
Amazing. I want to talk about the heart of music. And Oliver, you said that music was or is the most important part of your psychotherapy.
No, I didn't quite say that. But what I did say is that in the course of psychotherapy sessions, music often comes into my mind. And unfortunately, my therapist himself is pretty musical, and he's usually able to identify the music and maybe to track things which are going on, which I'm not conscious of, but which the music gives a clue to, because music is so inseparably connected with memory and emotion, including unconscious memories and emotions or repressed ones. So there's a great deal can be revealed this way.
Well, you quoted Theodore Reich, who talked about music giving the analyst a clue about the secret life of emotions.
Freud spoke of dreams as the royal road to the unconscious, and I think this is considerably so of music, which has such profound emotional effects and is evocative in such complex ways. The whole of Proust's great book, amongst other things, has to do with musical association.
Daniel, before we go to six songs or six melodies, I'm curious about music and moods. We go towards music that tends to match our moods, not change them. When we feel sad or despairing, we usually go towards sad music and not happy music. And it's the same thing with happiness. One would think when someone's sad, they'd go towards uplifting music.
Yes, and it's an interesting case of why sad music is comforting. And I think that in many cases, when we're sad, we feel misunderstood or you know, cut off from other people, and we feel alone in our state. And when the right sad song comes on, with or without lyrics, we suddenly feel that we're no longer alone at the edge of the cliff. There's somebody there standing with us, somebody who's been through a sad, depressing experience also. And we find some comfort in that. We feel understood. And moreover, we have the realization that this person who went through the experience came out the other side. They lived, they survived, and they turned it into a beautiful work of art, which is inspiring. I think the essential point, too, is, as you mentioned, music is about emotion. Although we may take intellectual and aesthetic pleasure in it also, it's primarily and fundamentally an emotionally communicative medium. If you feel the same way at the end of a piece of music as you felt at the beginning, I would argue that that piece of music has failed.
Well, that leads us to the title of your book, The World in Six Songs. It's really six themes. What are the six themes that music encompasses?
Well, the idea is that by looking at these six forms of music, songs of friendship, joy, comfort, knowledge, religion, and love, we can better understand the way in which our ancestors communicated with each other in ways that help to form social bonds and ultimately to strengthen society.
So one of the themes, well, let's listen to one of the songs, and you can tell us what theme that addresses. Let's start with, we've got Joni Mitchell. Okay.
Of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that we
Daniel.
Yep.
I have to tell you, I don't even know you, but listening to that song with you, I like you better.
And I think that's the point. You know, when Oliver talks about having strong memories of music, or you talk about it, I think that's the reason we have music. Evolution selected it as a way to carry meaning to a certain extent. Songs are meant to be memorable and get stuck in our heads. They're not meant to irritate us. That happens by accident. But the fact that so many of us have these rich memories of music, or that music can become associated with memories so strongly, that does suggest that it was selected for by an evolutionary process. In this particular case, I see this as a kind of song that is perhaps the most ancient of all. It's a song to convey knowledge. The singer is trying to share not just her emotional state, but an experience of deep reflection that she went through. She's trying to encapsulate some knowledge in a song so that she can share it with us. One of the ways that humans differ from other animals is we have self-consciousness. We're aware that the contents of our thoughts might be different from the contents of another person's thoughts. And that leads to a drive to communicate. If you and I have access to different information, we want to reach one another. We want to talk. We want to sing. We want to share information.
One of the themes that this addresses, though, I mean, there are several themes in your book that you talk about. Comfort, friendship, joy are some of the themes that music, categories that music fall into. But the feeling I get is it's a kind of bonding often. That music can promote bonding that other things can't. Words?
I think that's true, and we now have some neurochemical evidence for this. There's a very interesting hormone called oxytocin that's released when people sing together. And this is a hormone that that actually causes feelings of trust and bonding with one another. It's the same chemical that's released when people share an orgasm together.
So it's the hormone that gets released by the music. And this happens more than with words when we agree on something. It happens more than, say, religions or being in a similar club together. It just feels more personal, more evocative.
It does seem to be unique in the extent of it. It seems to be unique to music. There are other chemicals released, too. When we were talking earlier about music that's pleasurable, that modulates dopamine levels in the brain, and Oliver can talk more about this than I, but you know, the simple way to think of dopamine is that it's the feel-good hormone. It regulates mood and alertness.
Well, Oliver, I am going to turn to you, and in the just 1 minute we have left, you said in your book we have a tendency to separate the mind and the brain from passion and emotions. Music really is about both the head and the heart, yes?
Yeah, I think they're absolutely inseparable, and in the formal beauty and the emotional hook sort of absolutely go together.
Yeah, and Daniel, it's nice to hear that you call yourself a romantic, and despite your research, you believe you'll never find out why people love different kinds of music.
Well, because I think the question is so rich and so full. It's a fun ride. But I think the end of it is never going to come.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? Because, you know, information interferes with wonder and faith. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guests have been Dr. Oliver Sacks, who is a well-known neurologist, author, researcher. He's written many books, and his latest one is Musicophilia. And he joined us from his home in New York. Daniel Levitin also joined us by phone. He is the author of The World in Six Songs. He's a cognitive psychologist. He's an ex, I guess, recovering music producer. He's also professor of psychology and music at McGill University. Well, earlier on, we heard from Conchetta Tomeno. She is director of music for music and neurologic function. She's vice president for music therapy at Beth Abraham Family of Health Services, and that is in New York City. Well, next week we're going to do a pre-election show that's going to talk about how we vote, what the psychology is in our voting choices. We can be reached at voices@whyy.org, and you can listen to an archived edition of Voices in the Family on our website. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. My heart's skipping a beat with this music. The engineer has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Peres-Loon is the executive producer. Mike and Scott's the executive producer. Our show is co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. Me, I'm a happy boy. Riders on the storm.